From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1908 with the construction of a house in Rochester. Today you know it as the Frank Lloyd Wright Edward E. Boynton House. It is the only Frank Lloyd Wright house in Rochester. And unlike some of Wright's most famous works, it remains a private residence. Frank Lloyd Wright is considered one of the great American architects. The Falling Water House, south of Pittsburgh, is maybe his best-known house. The American Institute of Architects named Falling Water the best all-time work of American architecture. This hour, we get the chance to sit down with a woman who grew up in the Boynton House. Living in a Frank Lloyd Wright house was a remarkable experience for Kim Bixler. Always fascinating, sometimes not easy. She's back in Rochester this weekend for a symposium on Frank Lloyd Wright and the Boynton House. That event is happening on Saturday at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Space is still available. They would love to see you there. We'll tell you about that coming up. Kim has become an outstanding storyteller herself, and we are glad to have her with us here on Connections. Kim Bixler, former resident of the Frank Lloyd Wright Boynton House, and an author and a public speaker and just a dynamic Frank Lloyd Wright expert herself. It's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
Absolutely. And you came back to Rochester for this weekend from where? Where is home for you now?
I live outside of Los Angeles in Manhattan Beach, California. Lived a lot of places since I left Rochester.
You still have a lot of fondness for Rochester.
I do. I mean, I spent most of my childhood here. I still have my friends that are here. You know, I have to go to the pizza place that I used to work at, which is Chester Cab, but it was called Pizza Station. That was one of my first jobs. So, of course, I have to check out all the old haunts that are still here.
Absolutely. The event on Saturday starts at, 9:30 with an optional tour of the Lion House, which is where the Rochester Academy of Medicine is housed. And then really starts in earnest at 10 a.m. and it goes to 1 p.m. at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. Who do you want to see there on Saturday?
I always find it a great treat to reconnect with some of the people that I actually grew up with. One of my favorite events, I did one at the Memorial Art Gallery, and I ended up getting some of the parents of my classmates when I grew up. And one of them informed me that our son is now an architect because he went through the house when you were giving tours when I was 8 years old. And I was like, that is magical. And since then, I've connected with him. And then I found out there was a second person became an architect. So I would really like to, you know, people don't have a chance. It's not open very often. The house is still privately owned. But I'm going to give everybody a great view of what the house looks like inside when we live there and then what it looks like today.
And Kim has no rivalry with the current occupants. In fact, WXXI in a documentary has covered the story there. And Kim has been not only kind of at the center of the history, but also very praising of some of the work that they have done there. Is that fair?
Yes. And it's really pretty a fascinating story about what happened with how I came up with the book and how I came up with the concept. And what happened was when I was 40, I blew out my knee and somebody sent me an article from the Democrat and Chronicle, that the house had been going up on the market. And I was like, you know what? I really should start writing some of these stories down of what it was like when I was growing up in that house. And my mom gave me boxes and boxes of materials. And then I wrote up, right in time for Christmas, a little set of stories about what it was like growing up in the house. And I gave them to everybody in my family and two people in Rochester. So I basically, and I said, read, edit, and enjoy. And so I gave everybody homework for Christmas. And they were like, thanks. But my parents and I got together, and then we started sharing tons of stories. And a couple weeks later, I get a phone call from WXXI, and they said, we're doing a PBS documentary about the house, and we just read your book. And I was like, my book, it's just a little set of stories. And so they said, no, but can we have your research materials, your notes, and can we film you and your mother going through the house as we restore it? And that is when I got to meet Jane Parker and Frank Cosentino, and I immediately fell in love with them. I mean, this house was 100 years old when they purchased the house, and it was pretty much in dire, it looked good. Kind of like the lipstick on the pig thing.
On the outside,
but I mean, major structural things, which I'll talk about on Saturday. There's some big problems with the house that took months. I mean, you spend 9 months just working on, you know, shoring up the foundation, refinishing the wood, fixing the windows. And that was before they even could start doing the restoration. And they did a combination of a restoration and a rehabilitation on the house.
And your sense is they have done a great service with it.
Oh, I mean, I think it'll last for at least another 100 years because of their, you know, tireless energy, their work. I mean, they made sure that everything was done, you know, the best way they could. They found the best craftspeople to make sure that house was done. But they also did a rehabilitation, which means that they wanted to bring it up to modern standards. They wanted things like air conditioning, which we never had when we were kids. They wanted a built-in dishwasher. Like, we had to literally drag our dishwasher across the kitchen and, like, screw it into the kitchen sink. Seven-zone heating. So, and then our refrigerator was the original ice box, and then they put in a regular refrigerator. So they did a combination of a restoration, but also making sure that it's livable. And what's the most amazing thing is that they taking all the trim off the house and fixing all the windows. It's like I looked back at pictures when we lived there, and I was like, wow, it was shabby, and it just shines. It's beautiful.
When you think about messing around, is the wrong word. Restoring, changing, updating, structurally repairing any kind of historic structure. There's always a debate about that. Now, in this case, it's privately owned and they could do what they want. But I'm thinking of something like the Chautauqua Institution. So my family, I have a lot of family in Chautauqua, and I've gone to weddings and events there. And that's, of course, the place where Salman Rushdie was nearly murdered and it became a national story. But that space is so beautiful and central. And there was this debate for years, much of the last decade. And do you knock the whole thing down and try to rebuild it as close to you as what it was? Because structurally, it's in kind of in trouble. Can you tinker? Can you keep the bones and repair? And it was very emotional for a lot of people in that community who not only are members, but care about the history of it. And I talked to restorationists. I talked to people in, you know, the Landmark Society, of course, is who you know well. And these debates are can be really, really tough. So for your taste, and we're going to talk in a moment what it's like growing up in a house, but now as someone who does not live in that house, did you think, hey, there should be some rules here? It's a Frank Lloyd Wright house. It's the only one in Rochester. He's maybe the greatest American architect. You should be able to do this, but not this. Or did you think, look, it's your house. You're going to do what you're going to do.
Well, anything that they did on the house, you have to go through three different organizations. You have to talk to the City of Rochester Zoning. You have to go through the Landmark Society of Western New York. And you also have to go through the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation. So there are a lot of restrictions on that house. And right before we moved in, the previous owners started doing putting protective covenants on the house. But my parents, I have all these, it was in that box that my mom gave me. It was like, whoa, I got to read all the protective covenants my parents added in addition. So what happened was that as we were about to purchase the house in 1977, the owners that were living there said, oh, by the way, you have to pay for the furniture separately. And my parents were like, we don't have the money for this. And they said, well, we could sell it to a third party. And my parents were horrified. There are 17 pieces of original furniture in that house. And so one of the first things they did is they put protective covenants. Well, first they went to the Landmark Society. This is why they have such a close relationship with them. And they said, we can't afford the furniture. So the Landmark Society ended up buying the furniture. And then they have a lease back. I think technically it's still in my parents' name because it's I know it's for 75 years for a dollar. And now you are never allowed to remove the furniture from the house. There's an amazing story that it did have to get relocated to the Memorial Art Gallery because the house was abandoned and the ceiling was falling in. But it has to stay in the house. But anytime they want to move a wall or knock things out, like the current owners wanted to demolish the garage and replace it because it was full of termite damage, they have to go through city, you know, the zoning, the Landmark Society, and then the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation. So it really isn't, you can't do everything.
Plenty of restrictions.
There are plenty, which means time and delays. And I think that they had the patience, and they also, you could tell that they cared. They went back and got all the original drawings on the house, and there were 70 original drawings of this house, and they made sure that it was done with the utmost care.
So they can't just say, you know, I think we're going to sublet this. I think a duplex.
Yep.
I think massive pink shutters.
Well, there was some crazy colors that were painted.
So before
we moved in, oh my gosh, I actually have a swatch of
did that get
wallpaper.
Approved?
Oh my gosh. So before, this is one of the reasons that the previous owners, so my parents also made sure that the colors have to remain a certain way. So there's a lot of restrictions. And if you guys ever want to go to the Darwin Martin house, it's a really interesting comparison because that house was torn, like picked apart. That's why there are windows from the Darwin Martin house in like the Chicago Art Institute. Even in Ithaca, New York, there's one of the windows in there. And so that house didn't have like this preservationist at the time. And now since they've done a complete restoration of that house, but they don't have a lot of the original pieces and parts because, you know, a lot of it was gone and walls were moved. And that was what's so unusual about our house. It was still kind of intact.
Yeah. We're talking to Kim Bixler, who lived in that house. From when to when, by the way? What year?
Oh, from 1977 to 1994. And yeah, it was pretty interesting times.
So former resident of the only Frank Lloyd Wright house in Rochester, the Boynton House, and author, people may wonder if they can get your book.
And the answer is no. the book is pretty much sold out. I know there's a few copies that are floating around.
This is what happens
when
you have low print runs and then you do better than you expect.
Exactly. Well, I did do a second printing was done, but I also had a little career change path. And then on my website, you can get a PDF. It's a hard copy, you know, full color book, but unfortunately, those aren't being printed right now, but there is a PDF that's available for $6. And if you go to my website, which is my name, kimbixler.com, also on my website, there's a gallery with all these great pictures of what the Boyntons look like. And because it was built for Edward E. Boynton, and he was widowed, and his 19-year-old daughter, Beulah. And this Sunday, when I first got to Rochester, I went to Mount Hope Cemetery, and I tracked down the grave site. And it was amazing to see, like, all the family there. Beulah was there. Edward Boynton, his wife. He lost three children. He had four children total, and she was the only surviving child. And he doted on her, and that's why he decided, I want to build this house. The two of us are going to live in Rochester in this house. And he brought Frank Lloyd Wright to Rochester and pretty much spared no expense building this house. It's top-notch.
There's something really beautiful about you deciding to go to the cemetery and pay that visit.
It was, you know, and I, for all the people at Mount Hope, I've seen pictures of it, but obviously somebody has taken the care to clean it. And I know there's not a lot of family left because I did a really extensive genealogy, but it was just, I don't know, it was really magical.
Well, let's go back a little bit. I want to do a little history lesson because this was good for me. I was telling Kim before the program, I went, oh, Frank Lloyd Wright. Of course I know Frank Lloyd Wright. And then I went like, well, I kind of do, but I mean, I don't know how many houses he did. I don't know when he started. I don't know why he was brought, like, I mean, you kind of just told the story, but there's got to be a little bit more here. I don't know how well he was known in 1908 to bring him to Rochester to do this. He's got houses in California, but as you've written about, they're quite different. He had different sort of eras of his own architectural styles. So a little history on Frank Lloyd Wright. 1908, when this house in Rochester is built, how big was Frank Lloyd Wright?
He was not very big. He was big in the Midwest. He was born in 1867. So think about, like, from the dawn of the Civil War, he had this career that went all the way till basically dawn of the space age. He died just before his 92nd birthday. But when he had really no technically training in schools. He dropped out of school after like 1.5 semesters of college, but he definitely was trained on the job. In his lifetime, he has designed over 1,100 structures. Over 500 were built, and about 434, 38 remain. But by 1908, he was quite successful in Chicago. In the Chicago area, Oak Park. And then he ended up in 1908 having an affair with one of his clients' wives. And he left his six children, and she left her two children. And then they went off to Europe because in Germany, they wanted him to do this portfolio of his current works. So when he did come back, this is going to be going, I don't want to spoil what happens on Saturday, but we're going to do a unbelievable tour of Frank Lloyd Wright's life, which is really quite remarkable.
I mean, it's it's got some twists and turns.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
and some tragedy and some, yeah.
Exactly. The only reason that he came to Rochester is because Edward Boynton was the partner in this Ham Lantern Company, and one of his business associates had his house designed by Frank Lloyd Wright in the Chicago suburbs in 1892. So he brought Frank Lloyd Wright to Rochester. And then Frank Lloyd Wright also had some great clients, the Martins, that were in Buffalo. But he wanted to be the world's famous, the most famous architect in the world. And by 1908, he was just the most famous in a relatively small region.
And so he comes to Rochester. It's the only house he does here.
Mm-hmm.
And your family arrives there in 1970. You said 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been different owners. But what do you remember? You're 8 years old. What do you remember most about the first visit? I mean, can an eight-year-old understand that this is a piece of American architectural history and you're actually just moving in?
You know, we always live in the weird house, you know, so I was kind of used to a weird house, but I've never been handed a set of note cards and say, go stand on the fireplace. There's a bunch of architects that are coming over and you need to give a tour. So that was a little different for me. And I think when you're eight, you feel like they are listening to me. They're really interested in the house. But I mean, my mom typed up these note cards, which she found about 10 years ago, in the back of a recipe box. So I have them. I actually brought them here with me. But I just, you know, I felt like I kind of had made it when I was eight. And then, you know, when most people bring something from home for show and tell, well, show and tell was my house. And I got to be like, everyone had to fill out permission slips to come to my house. So I knew something was really different. But by the time I was a teenager, instead of that kind of feeling of self-importance and pride, I was really self-conscious about my house, you know, and I felt a little like, you know, people like, oh, you live in a mansion, you live in a museum. And, you know, kids are a little bit cruel. So I kind of didn't, you know, advertise where I lived, you know, at that point. But when I first moved in there, I was like, wow, I am like a star. I'm standing on the fireplace talking to all these famous, you know, these people.
Well, I think everybody listening can relate to the idea that they've been in someone's home, an apartment, a house, where there's a room where it looks like no one's ever sat on the furniture, and you think, like, is this the museum part? You know, there are memes now about what Gen Z is going to think of, you know, china cabinets and things like that. Like, here, you throw this away. Whereas our older generation, like, whoa, how dare you? You know, this is an important... And I understand things change over generations. I do not seek to offend anybody with those comments. I'm just bringing up the idea that not every house, but a lot of places, homes, apartments, have a part of the house where it's like, you don't sit on the furniture. We don't go in here. We don't touch this. And you wonder, why do we have this room if no one's allowed in here? Did your house feel like that? Or did it really feel like, you know what? I know it's different, but it's lived in. It's just a house.
Yeah, I wasn't a feral child, but I was pretty close. I mean, my parents, you know, we'd go out, you know, we'd just be playing in the yard. We'd be playing, you know, Ghost in the Graveyards. We played kickball all the time.
That's our generation's no Ghost in the Graveyard. I played that growing up too.
I mean,
I don't know if kids today do.
Yeah, and it's like, don't even come back until it's dinner time.
That's right.
You know,
that's
and
right.
See you later. And then after dinner, go out there and play until it's dark.
Oh, or in the
dark.
Exactly. In the dark.
In the
dark.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, for us, it was interesting because my mom and dad really did a good job of making it feel like it's our home. I mean, we ate at that Frank Lloyd Wright table, and it has all this little trim. And we had this little drawer that anytime a little piece of trim broke off, we would just put it in the drawer. And my mom's like, one of these days we'll have this, you know, it has to be restored professionally. She's not going to go and, you know, nail it back in there. But to this day, I truly cannot use a coaster. I mean, can't live without using a coaster. It's like been hammered in my head. Everything, you have to have a coaster on all the furniture because that was very precious. But you know, we used to play crazy games. We had played this game. There was these oriental rugs all through the house. We used to play this game called Rug Jumper. So you're never allowed to touch the wood on the floor, which is hot lava. So we'd be jumping from literally a Frank Lloyd Wright table to a rug to the radiator things. We used to take sleeping bags, and we would go down the staircase head first. You know, I was like, oh, my gosh. You know, and my mom was just like, whatever, you know.
You're, have at it.
It's you know, your kids, you know, and you're going to have a good time. But you got to make sure that you clean your room and you make your bed, you know, because there's going to be a tour. You know, occasionally there will be a tour. So to be on the ready. But we didn't have as many tours as the previous owners.
Forgive my ignorance on this, but is there a lot of lead in the house?
No. So the windows, we don't call them leaded glass windows because they're the caming, the metal, that's zinc. Okay, and so we call them art glass windows because they need to be more structurally sound in that zinc caming. And in terms of paint, you know, the house was done in 1908, and it had been painted over. I remember when my parents started stripping the paint, there were like eight on some of the places. There were like eight different layers. You could have like a history of what it was like. Now it's all wood in the whole house, and then there's just, you know, like a little coat of paint. But the windows were not. There was no lead there, and I don't remember ever hearing about lead. The basement was asbestos, though. So we had all the pipes were down there with asbestos, and that has all been taken away. So,
I wonder sometimes when it comes to great architecture, is it great if it is visually striking, or does it also have to be functional?
I don't know. If it depends on if you're living it, but
I mean, that's the thing. You're one of the few people who actually did live it.
Yeah. So, and I'm going to show on Saturday. I'll show some interesting pictures, but the light fixtures, they're really intricate, and they've got these squares on them. And the square, the base of the light fixture, is the same size as the square in one of the window panels. And then the other part of the light, the window fixture, is the same size as the light fixture. And there was this repetition of geometry and shapes, and that matches the tables. So even when you're like 8 years old and you walk into that room, you're like, there's something magical about this room. But what it is, it's a balance, a symmetry. It's something about the design that's really pleasing to the eye because of the shapes are all, in alignment. It's just really, really remarkable. And there are 253 stained glass windows, doors, and light lenses in this house, and 17 pieces of furniture, like I mentioned. And they're all unique to this house. So if you found a window, you can track it to whatever Boynton house it is. If you found a piece of furniture, you would know. And a great story is that I was doing a talk in Iowa, and I walked into this house, and I was like, that's the buffet table from the Boynton house. And they're like, you're right. And so then I did some research, and I figured out why they had a buffet table in the house.
How many Frank Lloyd Wright houses that we know of?
That are still standing, like maybe 434, wow. 38. Okay, this is another crazy story. So maybe 8 months ago, I get this message on Facebook or something, and there's a guy who's building a replica of the Boynton house in the Isle of Man, like off the coast of England. And he is just, he got my book. I don't know. We have become like fast friends. It's like this strange, like interesting thing. But he'll send like pictures every 3 days. And I'm kind of intrigued. I'm like, I'm deep in. I'm in. This is like an interesting mystery. But I still look at some of the windows and the way he did it. I'm like, it's a little different. You know, it's a little like, because I've seen those windows so many
times.
Don't
crush his spirit, Kim.
I know. Just the windows are. The windows are. Just the windows. But he did. He came to the U.S. and he did go through the house, and he did say, oh, I wish I had seen this house in person before, because he could see there's some like slight differences. But that's how, there are fans out there of Frank Lloyd Wright. And I got to love them because, you know, it's magical.
Well, why and when did you decide that you did want to go deep on Frank Lloyd Wright, because, you know, you have said that when you were 8 years old, maybe it was a little over your head, but you enjoyed the tours and, you know, it was exciting. You hit your teenage years. Now it's kind of a different thing.
Yeah.
Now you wish the world wasn't looking at you as the center of attention sometimes. And then you get to adulthood, and at what point, because some people just disengage and they say, look, I lived there. My family doesn't live there. I don't live there. It was an experience, but I'm moving on. Why have you gone deep on Frank Lloyd Wright?
It was primarily because when the house was purchased in 2009, and you know where, like this is the person's house. Like forever, there's certain houses in a neighborhood. They're like, oh, that's the McDonald's house. That's the, you know, turn left at the, you know, the Truett's house. Turn left at, you know, the Dorschel's house or whatever. So you know that house, even though they haven't lived there in forever. So I'm telling you, however many people sent me that article when the house was purchased in 2009, you know, I was like, okay, you know, we haven't even been there since 1994. But once I connected with those people, you know, Jane and Fran, it was really amazing to go back to the house again. And I hadn't been there for years. And I thought, this is a treasure, a Rochester treasure. And once I started doing the research, the more and more research I did, I interviewed every single person who's ever lived in that house. I found the original, the Times Union. I found the Times Union newspaper reporter that interviewed Beulah Boynton.
Wow.
I am a research nerd. And once I started, man, I was like, this is fascinating. So I think that I have that newspaper article from 2009, and that just like kicked off something. It's like going down the rabbit hole in the internet. You just keep on going. But this was just going down the Boynton House rabbit hole, and it's just fascinating.
Well, I mean, and you get to stay connected to the home where you spent a lot of your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's special. I mean, I went back when I turned 18, my parents moved. My twin brother and I are out of the house, and they're downsizing. And I went back a few years ago, and I had not been in the house since they sold it when I was 18 years old. And I wanted to see it. I was just curious. It's not a Frank Lloyd Wright house. It is the most, you know, cookie cutter. It's not cookie cutter. It's okay. But it's not Frank Lloyd Wright. I just wanted to see it. I wanted to stand in the place where I had memories as a child. And so I didn't know if I was going to knock at the door or kind of walk around back and see what the backyard looks like where we played all those wiffle ball games. And then a woman pulled up and... She actually said to me, did you lose your dog? You're like, look like you're walking around. I said, no, actually, I grew up here. And she said, you must be the O'Shea's. And I said, no, we were before the O'Shea's. It was the Burks. It's my mother's married name. And she said, you know, I'd invite you in, but, you know, you know what the house looks like. And I went, yeah. You know, like I didn't have the courage that Kim Bixler would have said, no, I need to see it. I'm here. I came all this way. But then she said something racist, and I'm like, okay, I'm leaving. She said something really jarring about the neighborhood and how it had changed, and I was so ill that I'm like, okay.
So you haven't been back in your house?
I have not been back in the house. And
oh, do they still live there?
They do. It's the same family and the same woman who said those like really bigoted things. And it was just so disappointing. And I was kind of sad about it. And so... But I do regret not seeing the space because I wanted to know what it felt like to stand and then look around, you know, and just think about.
Well, first of all, it's going to look a lot smaller than you remember. That was my first impression.
Is that always like the key?
I went in there.
Like, wait a second. This was huge.
I know. This was enormous. Oh, my gosh. This is a small little entryway, you know. And so, I mean, that was the one thing. Oh, and so before when we first moved to Rochester, we lived in a different house. So that I did the same thing, and I went over and I said, you know, when I was researching the book, I said, I'm writing this book. I keep on talking about this house being so unusual because my parents like the oddball houses in the street. Can I come in? And she's like, no. I just remember being so incensed because even today, wherever I live, I'm like, hey, you want a tour of my house? And they're not even remarkable.
Well, I can't imagine someone showing up at my door saying, I used to live here, and me saying, awesome, hit the bricks.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, I think I would want to be generous and say, oh, did you want to take a look around?
Yep.
I don't get that.
Yeah. I mean, I know I did and do not do this. I'm asking, begging people, don't do this on the Frank Lloyd Wright house. But all the time when I was growing up, we would have people knocking on the door, begging for a tour. And a lot of times, it was a different era then, I would let them in. You know, I would just, you know, if their story was really interesting. One guy had like come from Germany and he rented a car and he was seeing every single house, Frank Lloyd Wright house, across the country. And he was literally just cold knocking on everybody's door. And my mom was like, that's the best story ever.
Yeah.
And so she just let this kid in. And then he said at the end, when he gets to California, he's going to sell the car and then go back to Germany, you know? And so I was just like, you know, so we did. And some of these people we let in the house, they were so interesting. We learned so much from them about this house as well. And when I interviewed everybody who came in the house, you know, I was just fascinated to hear. Some loved it, some hated it. It was very polarizing living in that house. It wasn't like everyone loved it. There was a love-hate. And the worst was when one person in a couple loved it and the other person hated it. And there was a lot of that, you know. And I would tend to, you know, when I talked to people on the phone, I remember one person was like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you. And an hour later, we're still talking. She's like, I told you, I do not want to talk to you. I was like, okay.
Most of the 400-plus Frank Lloyd Wright houses are not private residences anymore. Is that correct?
I would, you know, I don't know the exact number, but there are a lot of so when I say they're not just houses, they're, you know, churches, they can be, he did a gas station, he did a dog house, but they, a lot of buildings, you know, like high rises even. So there's really a range, and a lot of them are publicly, there's a website, I think you can just go on and Google how many are open to the public. And if you can do nothing, you have to go to Falling Water.
I was going to ask you about Falling Water, because Falling Water, of all the Frank Lloyd Wright houses, it has to be the best well-known.
Mm-hmm.
It's heralded as the marvel of American architecture, and it's a museum, right? I mean, that's what it is now.
It's just open for tours.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, as someone who's lived in a Frank Lloyd Wright mm-hmm. house and as someone who's an aficionado,
mm-hmm.
do you view this as like, people are like, oh, I love the Beatles, but like, I don't need Love Me Do. I like, you know, the more esoteric stuff. Or do you think like, no, that's a classic? How do you feel about Falling Water?
It's not even a classic. It's so unique. It's so unusual. It's so different than ours. It's 100% worth a trip. And do a tour of that house. It's amazing. And also, that was a house in the same situation that our house was, you know, that was going to fall into the water. And it had to be, you know, substantial work to shore it up and to make it last for another 100 years. And that had been donated, you know, to Pennsylvania. And so it was... You know, it was some trouble, you know, getting funds. I think it's a remarkable house. The Guggenheim is also fascinating just in terms of the building. And he built that, that was finished 6 months after he died, when he was almost 92. So yes, I would drive to Falling Water. That one should be seen. And then if you get a chance to go into the Boynton House, I know that the Landmark Society, in the fall, they have a lottery system because it's such in demand, and it's a fundraiser. It's a good one.
Worth trying to do, yeah.
It's a great one.
Let me take a phone call. We're talking to Kim Bixler, a former resident of the Frank Lloyd Wright Boynton House in Rochester. And Kim is back in town from her now home in California. Mm-hmm. But she's back in Rochester for the week, and on Saturday, there is a half-day symposium. It's at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. If you go to I don't think I have to say that anymore, but I still do it, FLW-Rochester at eventbrite.com, you can get all the information you need, and we'll post a link on our show notes if you want to take a look. Tickets are still available for the event and the symposium on Saturday. Kim's got a lot planned. There's a lot of people involved, and I know they would love to see you there.
If you use the code WXXI, you can get $10 off.
I did not know that.
Yes, I had it was set up so that there would be a code.
Once I got
invited on, I was like, great.
Kim thinks of everything. This is Rick in Pittsford. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. How's it going?
Good.
I love your show. I've been a big fan for a long time.
Oh, thank you.
We met the McDonald's, and Kim mentioned them earlier. They're friends of ours. And we met in 97. In 1999, before our son was born, we had our baby shower at the Blayton House. And then, and I remember hearing from Katie McDonald, that she would just be coming down to get coffee or tea, and I think Kim can probably relate to this. And she would walk down, and there would be people peeping in their windows.
Yes, definitely.
They would literally have their faces pressed against, like, different windows looking in. And Katie would go out and say, excuse me, but she goes, oh, well, you know, we just wanted to see the house. And as Kim mentioned with the Landmark Society and stuff, you can book things like that. But she said it was really interesting never knowing when you were going to have somebody peeping in your house, peeping in your house. I mean, it wasn't at night and stuff. It was usually during the day. But it's a lovely house. I know they, I don't know who they bought the house from, but I know they also, archivists tried to take it down, tried to do as much as they could to get it back to its original footprint. Not like the current owners I've heard, but, they spent a substantial amount of money trying to do that. And, Kim mentioned that the person that was inspired to go into architecture after visiting the Frank Lloyd Wright house when she was younger. We have black slate countertops in our house as we speak, because we were inspired by the black slate countertops in the Frank Lloyd Wright house.
Wow. Funny story is whenever my brother and I, we would have people in the windows, and we were just kids. We would like jump scare, and like we would be tormenting them. Like, you know, they would peek in the windows and we would be like trying to torment them. And if people were like sketching our house, we would stand behind them and we're like, yeah, we've seen better. I mean, we were terrible. So like, at least we were like, had this like, kind of like craziness. My brother and I were like little terrors to the poor people that came to the house.
Well,
and Kim, you probably watched it, but I was at the kind of cocktail party, wine party at the house when Ken Burns did the documentary on Wright, and they had a kind of a social gathering for him on the release of the documentary. So he's a lovely man, incidentally, Ken Burns.
Wow, so. I have not met him, but. You know, I saw the PBS documentary at the Little Theater. I don't think you ever want to see your face 40 feet that big. I can tell you I didn't. I was tormented forever after that.
Well, thank you for the phone call. And the idea of, it's one thing that people want to tour your house. It's another that they might just stop and look in through the windows. That is disturbing.
Oh, I agree. Don't do that. There used to be a little sign that said private residence, but I don't know. It's just some people are really, really curious, but it's...
How does a teenager bring home a date if people might be looking in the windows?
I know. You can't don't.
Do it. Yeah, yep. You have fun somewhere else.
Well, we used to have this series of flat roofs. My poor mom, luckily I'm married now, but I used to like sneak out in the middle of the night and climb down the flat roofs along the house. And every once in a while I'd have somebody knocking on those, climbing up those windows. So don't tell anybody, but no.
Kim is putting all of the stories out this hour.
Yes.
Patrick writes to say, what's up with the landscaping? He says, and Patrick is a landscaper. He says, if memory serves, it's grass foundation... A foundation out front. I don't know if that's supposed to be the look for whatever reason. So what is the story with the landscaping? Has that changed?
It's really amazing because the house in the 1920s, the lot went from an acre to a half an acre because now there are three huge, substantial houses on the property, the other part of the property that was sold off. I talk about this during the talk on Saturday. And in order to try and make the house look like it was on the prairie, because Frank Lloyd Wright wanted it to look like it fits the landscape, the current homeowners, how do you make a lot that's now half the size look big again? And the way that the landscape architects did it is they took out the driveway in the front of the house. There was a driveway and a walkway, and now you enter from the back of the house, and now there's just a walkway. And then they put the grass, the prairie, right up to the house. And so it's a very different treatment. In the book, I have literally a like timeline of all the houses. Some people had the bushes all the way up to the top of the second floor roof. So it's definitely different, but I think that it's like, I don't know, it really, to me, there's something about clean. The house looks so contemporary. Think about it, 1908, but having the landscaping done that way, I think it really makes the clean lines that Frank Lloyd Wright would have enjoyed even pop even more.
I think you have said, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you've said that your evaluation of the people who grew those bushes up to the second floor is that they were claiming, well, Frank Lloyd Wright wanted privacy, but you said you think they wanted the privacy.
I totally think so. And yes, this is a story for not the radio, because I know everybody's stories, but yeah, they end up having a divorce. And we'll just leave it at that. So.
Okay. Emily writes to say, Evan, I grew up across the street from Kim at number 29. One of my childhood memories is going to her brother's birthday party, which in fact was a piñata party that was more thrilling to me than the house.
Oh my gosh. So my dad's from San Diego, California. And so we spent all the money. My parents spent almost all their money renovating and fixing the house up. But once a year in February during our little winter break, we went to California to visit my grandparents, and we always got piñatas. And that was like the highlight of our birthdays every single time. That is such a great like flashback memory for me. And my mom, you know, we just loved, you know, who doesn't love like, you know, bashing, you know, a you know, stuffed thing full of candy. Woo, we loved it.
Wait a second. I'm seeing an event that's happening. Is this today? Thursday, July 25th, 2024 is in fact today.
Yes.
Falling Water, the story behind Frank Lloyd Wright's most famous architectural design.
Exactly. So it's not me. So I'm doing the symposium with a co-presenter who we get along great, and he is doing a talk at the Winton Library today at 4 o'clock. It's free. Hopefully it's not full yet. Today at 4, and it's specifically about Falling Water. And he is an expert, and he is the one who's going to be talking about Frank Lloyd Wright's life on Saturday.
Timothy Totten.
He's from Florida. So when I knew I was going to be in town, we both reached out to the Landmark Society. We did a talk last night in Syracuse for the American Institute of Architects at the Everson Museum. So we just said, okay, let's. And then I did a talk in Penfield on Monday. And he's doing a talk right now about the Imperial Hotel designed by Frank Lloyd Wright in Buffalo right now. So we can't stop talking about Frank Lloyd Wright, apparently.
Amazing. So that's today at 4 o'clock at the
Winton Library.
At the Winton Library. Mm-hmm. Nick in Fairport says, Evan, there's a great, albeit fictionalized, book on Wright named The Women by T.C. Boyle. Mm-hmm. Curious to know if your guest has read it and or has an opinion on it. It portrayed Wright as part genius, part con man.
Yes, and I did read it. Oh, gosh, I read it many, many years ago. Of course, it had a very different angle, and I thought that, I thought it was interesting, but I tend to lean more towards nonfiction a little bit more, and I guess it was hard for me to reconcile what I know about Frank Lloyd Wright as a person and the story, but there was I would have to have a refresher about what the book was, but I mean, about the content. But I do remember reading it at one point and saying, okay, that's a different take.
Well, so let me ask you a separate question. And I know you're going to go deep on Frank Lloyd Wright on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Lloyd Wright, for all the interesting architecture, his life was colorful and not always in the best ways.
Right.
When you think about the modern debate about separating art from the artist or... whether your appreciation for a great piece of art, a great piece of music, whatever the genre, is it eroded, affected, eliminated if you find out that morally you don't agree with the person or that they did things that you found reprehensible? Can you separate those things?
I have more trouble than other people do. I don't love it. I mean, for Frank Lloyd Wright, I'm not going to try and give him an excuse, but I think you have to have an incredibly healthy ego in order to become successful, because being successful is not just the work you do, it's promoting yourself and sending yourself out there. But I do think there's a line that you cross, and then I just think that was, I thought it was really unacceptable, I guess, you know, some of the things that he did. It made his life very dramatic. I would highly recommend learning more about Frank Lloyd Wright. On Saturday, he had stuff that happened in his life that very few people know about. And it was pretty dramatic lifestyle. And then at one point, you have some sympathy for him. But I still think your moral compass should point, pretty north,
Sure. And I also think it is... It's different to me when the artist is still alive versus when they have passed, to try to separate those things, because they may still be profiting from your fandom if they're still alive. And I'm not like I don't want a caricature. I'm not like a cancel everybody guy or no one can be redeemed. I don't think that's healthy. But I do at times find myself a little squeamish, depending on the person and the situation.
Yes.
And I just wonder if you think that the biography that we have publicly of Frank Lloyd Wright is accurate. I know you're a researcher. You go down a lot of rabbit holes. Mm-hmm. Does the public fully understand this man?
You know, I think it depends. I think his personal life and his professional life, there's two different tracks. If you just talked about his personal life, you would be like stunned, disgusted, whatever. So I have toured a ton of Frank Lloyd Wright houses. I gave tours all the time. Mm-hmm. I never knew anything about his personal life until much, much later. And it was actually the book Loving Frank. I remember reading that. I was a fully formed adult. And I was like, what? That happened? So I noticed that a lot of those Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, structures, those tours, they don't talk about his personal life very much.
Should they?
It's a pretty amazing story. It's dramatic. But I think that they are afraid what you're saying. It tarnishes his reputation. It tarnishes his accomplishment and what he's doing. And they're just saying, "This, look at this building for what it is."
Sure.
At this point.
Yeah, I understand that.
But I just went back to school to NYU when I was in my 50s to write musicals, and I wrote a musical about Frank Lloyd Wright's life because it is so full of drama. It is amazing.
Now, where can we see that musical?
Come on. I know. Not yet. You know, it's not.
Sometime
it's not finished.
In the future?
During the pandemic, I would be doing a lot of these presentations, and I took the music from the songs, and the songs are almost like little scenes at this point, and I made little videos, and I would do speaking engagements all over the country about Frank Lloyd Wright's life set to music. And now that I've had the formal training, I finished the musical beforehand, but now that I've had the formal training, I'm like, I could use a workshop or a polisher. So, you know, Jiva Theater, I mean, I think that'd be a good place because, you know,
it's
hometown
the pitch
crowd.
There. Yeah. Kim Bixler's musical could have a world premiere at some point there. Before I let you go, a listener wanted to know if you had, any stories to confess about, like, breaking the furniture or anything like that when you lived there? Because you said there are how many pieces of original furniture?
17 pieces.
And you were careful with coasters. You didn't want to damage anything. I mean, like, I think of this time. The only thing that I remember growing up with that was, like, a meaningful thing was, like, this huge fish tank. It was, like, ornate. And it was in my twin brother in my room. I think we were, like, 6 years old. And my mother sat down in the afternoon, and she lit a cigarette, and she's watching. She called them her soapies. And she said, "Boys, do not bother me for the next hour unless it's an emergency. Like, do not." Mm-hmm. So we were upstairs playing in the bedroom, and I just remember he tripped on something, and I'll never forget the image of him falling forward with his arms wide and his forehead crashes into the fish tank. And everything is pouring out now. There's a shard of glass in his head. There's blood everywhere. Fish are coming and flopping on the floor. And I slowly went downstairs, and I said, Mom, you know how you said only if it's an emergency? And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "I think Drew might be dying." So we rushed upstairs. We flushed the fish down the toilet, as I recall, and that was the end of that thing. And a listener wants to know: Do you have anything to confess with the Frank Lloyd Wright house? Did you break anything like that you remember?
I didn't break anything, but I have one terror story. If you look, there's this trim all over the exterior of the house, and you know, keep in mind, I have a brother who's 2 years younger than me, so I was always daring him to do things, and so he is on the second floor of the house, okay? And I dare him to get out from my bedroom and walk across this trim, which is not, I mean, it's totally decorative trim. There's nothing support about it. Luckily, he weighed like practically nothing. And then go into the bathroom window. So he is scaling this. And then my mom comes out and sees him. And she's like, "Do I scream and startle him and he falls to his death? Is the trim going to hold?" I mean, she was like livid.
How old were you?
Oh, probably 8. I think that might have been one of the days too that I went around the house and I was like, try and eat this penny. Now eat this rock. Now eat this. Oh, my poor brother.
Your six-year-old brother.
I know. So,
but he did not fall to his death.
He did not. But I still, every time I see that trim, I go, oh, my gosh. There's, I cannot believe I did that. And then I dared him once to go through the laundry chute. And it was funny. When I went back and visited the house, I opened up the laundry chute. And I was like,
small?
There's no way. He would have been trapped in the laundry chute halfway through. So it is just, but anyway, I know all the great hiding places and all that other stuff. So anyway, that was a great question.
Listeners have found out why we wanted Kim Bixler around for the hour. You really are a fabulous storyteller. And, you know, you continue to do a great service to this community because, you know, if you joined us late here, Kim grew up in the only Frank Lloyd Wright house in Rochester, the Boynton House. But now has become a real researcher and an expert on Frank Lloyd Wright and is back to help lead this symposium at the Rochester Academy of Medicine on Saturday. They'd love to see you there, 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's a half-day symposium at the Academy of Medicine. Tickets are still available. And Kim and others will be there to tell stories and great chance to learn a lot more. If you're one of the people who can't get tours in the fall when you got to win the lottery. So.
Exactly.
If you're one of the people who look in the windows, which I don't think you should do, maybe just go on Saturday. I hope you have a great time there. Thank you for sharing these stories with us.
Yep.
And Kim's book is not available. There's not enough of those, but the musical will be forthcoming. And then you'll come back here and we'll talk about the music.
Sounds good. You can go on my website, kimbixler.com, also to get the tickets for this Saturday and use WXXI for the code for $10 off.
Kimbixler.com. Thank you, Kim.
Yep.
From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.